Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And joining us now, Democratic political consultant David Axelrod, very well known for running President Obama's successful campaigns. He also hosts the Axe Files on CNN. And Republican strategist Mike Murphy, who has worked with many leading Republicans, including John McCain and Mitt Romney and many others. Together, David Axelrod and Mike Murphy are now doing a podcast with the self-deprecating title Hacks on Tap. In the latest installment, which just came out last night, they talk about a big red flag for Donald Trump, the apparent defection of many non-college educated women, also the tension revealed among Democrats in an interestingly worded poll question. Do you want more someone with new ideas or more a return to pre-Trump normalcy? Murphy and Axelrod also talked to former Trump communications director Anthony Scaramucci, who's now trying to recruit other former Trump appointees to come forward and blow the whistle on just how hateful and epically, fundamentally wrong they really think the Trump presidency is. Yes, Anthony Scaramucci is doing that. We'll play a clip of Scaramucci coming up. So David Axelrod and Mike Murphy, thanks so much for joining us. Congratulations on the podcast and welcome to WNYC.
Great to be with you.
Yeah, thanks for having us. We figured the world needed another podcast.
I guess so, about politics especially. Can we start with that poll question for Democrats? David, who asked it, and what was the wording, as close as you can recall?
The question relative to normalcy versus change. Right. You know, this was in a Fox News poll, and before everyone rolls their eyes, I have to say, the Fox News polls have been very, very good over time. So good, in fact, that President Trump denounced it in the last few days because he thought it wasn't sufficiently friendly to him. Mm-hmm. But as part of it, they had a Democratic primary component. They asked Democratic primary voters, would you vote for a candidate who will restore the country? Would you prefer a candidate who will restore the country, get American politics back to normalcy, or a candidate who will fundamentally change the way things work in Washington? And by 60 to 36, they chose the candidate who will restore the country and get American politics back to normalcy. And of course, this is an important question because it is at the core of the battle between particularly Joe Biden, who has staked his campaign to the return to normalcy, and Elizabeth Warren, in particular Bernie Sanders, who are calling for a bold structural change. In fact, Elizabeth Warren, I was just in Iowa, she has that honk if you want bold structural change on her bus, on her campaign bus. So she's not very subtle about it. She's very clear that that's what she is representing. But it was an interesting finding.
Does that finding, if it really isn't, it's just one, you know, result in one poll, but if it's 50 to 36% for return to normalcy as opposed to bold structural change, did this surprise either of you? Mike, for you as a Republican strategist, did it surprise you if that was a finding among Democrats today?
Not quite. I think, you know, these proxy questions, they have a little room for interpretation by the voter who may put them through his or her own prism when they answer them, because they might think just, you know, Democratic government post-Obama is normalcy. But I think the thrust of it is something we see even in parts of the Republican Party, which is Trump fatigue. The daily reality show, the tweeting, the spats, I guess today were, you know, offending Denmark, one of our oldest and closest.
Thank God we finally have a president who's willing to take on the Danes. That's what I'd say.
But wait, why would Trump...
No, that Lego's getting on my nerves. I agree with somebody
I will digress with you on this. Why would Trump want to buy Greenland, a place where global warming is so apparent?
I would have thought it would have been Iceland just because of his obsession with models and everything. But it's, you know, trying to fathom that maze is impossible. I think just to sum up on that question, there is a tension in the Democratic Party between kind of a populist, it's almost symmetrical to what Trump did in the Republican Party, a populist revolt against norms with huge changes, in this case ideological, Warren and Sanders, or, you know, Joe Biden, who's trying to be the comfortable old shoe, less drama, get back to quote-unquote normal. The question for Biden is, can he grab that majority appetite and dominate it enough to become, you know, the Democratic nominee when he's got these vigorous challenges coming from that progressive wing that has so much energy in the primary?
And you played on your podcast a clip of Jill Biden, Joe's wife, from a campaign event in New Hampshire, kind of leaning into this as an argument for her husband in the primaries. Here's that clip.
Your candidate might be better on, I don't know, health care than Joe is. But you've got to look at who's going to win this election. And maybe you have to swallow a little bit and say, okay, I sort of personally like so-and-so better. But your bottom line has to be that we have to beat Trump.
Joe Biden. Yeah. David, why'd you play that clip?
Well, look, I think, first of all, it was interesting, but it became more interesting the next day yesterday when the Biden campaign rolled out its first campaign ad in Iowa, and it was very explicit about electability. He's the guy who can beat Trump. He was the guy who was Obama's partner. He's the guy who can restore decency to the White House. So, you know, when the thing first happened, people said, whoa, Jill Biden, she's freelancing in a way, but she wasn't. This is their strategy, and it's not a stupid strategy. I think Democrats are very hungry, and poll after poll you see it, that the most important thing to a majority of Democrats is to defeat Trump, and this is a strength of Biden's. The trap for Biden is if he somehow begins to look a little more risky, if he looks a little frail, feeble, not you know, up to it, this argument could unravel. I've said from the beginning, this is Joe Biden's race to lose, and the question is whether he's up to losing it. Mm. And I still think that's the case, you know, and poll after poll suggests that.
I thought people might want to hear that first campaign commercial that you were analyzing in your podcast. So listeners, here it is, Joe Biden's first campaign ad just released.
We know in our bones this election is different. The stakes are higher, the threat more serious. We have to beat Donald Trump. And all the polls agree Joe Biden is the strongest Democrat to do the job. No one is more qualified. For 8 years, President Obama and Vice President Biden were an administration America could be proud of. Our allies could trust and our kids could look up to. Together, they worked to save the American economy, to pass the historic Affordable Care Act, protecting over 100 million Americans with pre-existing conditions. Now, Joe Biden is running for president with a plan for America's future, to build on Obamacare, not scrap it, to make a record investment in America's schools, to lead the world on climate, to rebuild our alliances. Most of all, he'll restore the soul of a nation. Battered by an erratic, vicious, bullying president, strong, steady, stable leadership. Biden, president.
I'm Joe Biden, and I approve this message.
I thought his first name was Joe. I guess it's Obama.
But not a bad first name in a Democratic race.
I guess not. Strong, steady, stable leadership was the end of that.
Yes.
Why isn't that, though, just another version of what Hillary Clinton tried in 2016? She ran on pulling together, was it stronger together? I think I remember mm-hmm. from the Democratic convention with, you know, the opposite, of course, being Trump is racist and divisive. It didn't work. And the we want bold structural change resistance then broke out after that election with this massive energy from the progressive wing. So, Mike, you want to take a shot at this? Why wouldn't this wind up the same way?
Well, it very well may. I think, you know, Biden's problem is all the incentives for him to a voter are long term, he can beat Trump, and that presupposes he's going to perform in the Democratic primaries in a way that makes him keep looking like a winner. One big loss, one trip, and you know that's kryptonite for him. All of a sudden, Superman can't lift up the locomotive. So the problem with the safe and secure and everything's fine and most qualified campaign is it is by definition a very boring campaign. There's no romance to it. There's no mission. But, you know, it's the card the Biden people have to play. I mean, I thought the Jill Biden thing was very interesting because on one hand, she made the case they have to make that he's the safe, strong way to beat Trump. But the way she made it was so inherently defensive. Well, it reminded me of kind of the mother talking to the reluctant bride. Okay, he's not the most handsome guy. Okay, you may not be crazy in love with him. But, you know, he's got a steady job. He means well. And so it's the best card they got, but it's just a tough card in a romance-laden primary where Elizabeth Warren's going to be leading a crusade, or maybe somebody else will, or you've got younger understudies to Biden like Buttigieg or maybe one of the centrists. So it's a tricky hand.
It is a tricky hand to some degree, but let's also not jump to the presumption that the entire Democratic electorate is an inflamed left. Isn't. There are a lot of moderate. The majority of voters in the Democratic Party describe themselves as somewhat liberal or moderate. And in fact, if you look inside polling, and I think Elizabeth Warren's run the best campaign of any candidate. Let me just say that to start. It's been masterful, and I think she is clearly a contender here. But she's doing very, very well among voters who describe themselves as very liberal. She's doing less well among the rest, and she hasn't broken through with white working class voters or black voters who are necessary. And this is, by the way, an important element of Biden's strength, is that he has been very, very strong with African American voters. Mm-hmm. And if he can maintain that, that's a firewall for him. But Mike makes an interesting point, which is when you're the front runner, you any stumble can kind of metastasize. It can become much more difficult for you. And Iowa is a real trap for him. I just was out there. I have a CNN X-Files TV show on Saturday night, which is kind of a profile of the Iowa caucuses, and I spent a few days out there. And the thing that struck me was there's deep affection for Biden, a lot of respect, but not a lot of enthusiasm, to Mike's point, whereas for Warren, there is a lot of enthusiasm. And, in a caucus, that's really important because people have to go out on a cold night, stand in front of their neighbors for hours, haggle, negotiate. It's an investment, and it requires enthusiasm. So if I were the Biden people, I'd be concerned about Iowa, which is, I think, why they started running ads today or yesterday.
Listeners,
and the other campaigns.
Go ahead, Mike. Go ahead.
In that calculus, because they're going to take that love for Biden, that energy, and Biden's campaign is going to be saying, "Hey, reward him. He's earned it, and he's the safe bet." The other campaigns are going to say, "We love him too. Give him a gold watch." That's why at the next debate, the ABC one coming up from Houston, if and we don't know this yet, Biden and Warren are on the same stage. That'll be very telling. Will Biden grab that center vis-a-vis Warren ideologically and try to draw those
and
lines?
Can he?
Yeah, right.
I mean, one of the questions is he wasn't very effective. I mean, in the first debate, he stumbled in dealing with Kamala Harris's challenge. In the second debate, he was like a ninja master fighting off everyone on the stage with kind of, retorts. But it wasn't, it wasn't masterful. It was adequate. Elizabeth Warren is a heavyweight debater. Just ask John Delaney, who's still picking himself up off the canvas. So if he's going to spar with her, he has to be prepared to spar with her, or someone else on the stage may do it instead.
When you talk about energy, and I want to give out the phone number because, listeners, we invite you in on this conversation with Democratic political consultant David Axelrod and Republican political consultant Mike Murphy, co-hosts now of the new podcast called Hacks on Tap. And David also hosts the Axe Files on CNN. We're not going to talk about Joe Biden for this whole hour. We have other things that we're going to get to. Some people are calling in to talk about this. Somebody's calling in to talk about Greenland. We will definitely take that call. And anyone else who wants to get in, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Just because you used Elizabeth Warren as the, you know, opposite of Biden, what would you say about Bernie Sanders? I mean, he won the policy primary in 2016, and he became, I think, if I remember the polls correctly, you can correct me if you're wrong, if I'm wrong, I think Bernie Sanders became the most favorably viewed national politician in America after the election. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he was a change candidate, and everybody's been running on the Democratic side to catch up to him since, or at least measure themselves against the bar that he set and in the context that he established. So compare Sanders 2016 to Biden 2020 or Elizabeth Warren 2020 in terms of trust, both for integrity and pro-worker change.
You know, first of all, Bernie Sanders, he's the Energizer Bunny in the sense that he's been going for half a century basically saying the same things, and he's been very consistent in his views. And he's very good on TV. He's unflappable. He has qualities, and he's got a very committed core following, particularly among younger people, because of his authenticity and consistency. But he was running in 2016 against Hillary Clinton. There was no one else in the field. He was really the change candidate versus the status quo candidate. He got 46% of the primary vote. He now has competition in that space. Elizabeth Warren has, if he set the tone and pace on policy, she has taken it to another level. She has a plan for everything that go pretty deep. She has carved into his support on the left. She has not, as I pointed out, carved into his support among white working class voters. But you look at all this polling, and he is he is running second, third in Iowa, maybe fourth, because his base has been diluted. He doesn't have the open field that he did before. In terms of esteem, Biden probably is slightly more popular than Bernie is with Democrats. Now Warren is creeping up. I respect Bernie, and I sat down with him and a bunch of other candidates out in Iowa, and I think he believes in what he's doing, takes some pride in the fact that he's pushed the debate. But you do have a feeling that maybe he missed his opportunity in 2016. It's going to be much, much tougher here.
Yeah, we've kind of been there and seen that with Bernie. And this, like any kind of popular performance thing, which politics does have, what's new? And now there's so much more competition for him. And so what scares me, if I were Bernie, what would scare me about the polling is they know me, yet I'm slipping. Hmm. They've tried the meal, and they're not really ordering it again, not the same numbers. So because he has a loyal fundraising base online, he can keep going forever and be a catalyst. But it just, all the trend lines for him are in the wrong direction as other candidates are becoming known.
We'll continue in a minute and change direction with David Axelrod and Mike Murphy, co-hosts of the podcast Hacks on Tap, and your calls. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, as we talk about the 2020 horse race. You know, mostly on this show, we talk about the issues. But when we do the horse race, let's own it. Maybe we'll play that fanfare for all our political analysis segments in 2020, just to be transparent when we are in this mode. Still with us are Democratic political consultant David Axelrod, very well known for running President Obama's successful campaigns. He also hosts the Axe Files on CNN, and Republican strategist Mike Murphy, who has worked with many leading Republicans, including John McCain and Mitt Romney and many others. Together, David Axelrod and Mike Murphy are now doing a podcast with the self-deprecating title Hacks on Tap. Let's take a phone call before we change direction. And Andrew in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Brian. Great show, by the way. I've been listening for a few years.
Thank you.
Thank you for doing the work. So, you know, my question is, Sanders seems to have, I tend to disagree a little bit with your pundits. Sanders seems to have a bit of a lead in terms of grassroots funding. His trend line is going up. Everybody else seems to have, be below him, like Warren, or Biden seems to have had most of his big donations at the beginning when he first announced. And, you know, there's other things. You know, Biden is not the only choice we have. So I'm thinking, you know, Sanders and his progressive base could probably ruin Biden's chances. You know, and even New York Times articles that came out earlier saying Obama doesn't even believe in Biden, these things could hurt him. Mm-hmm. What do you guys think?
Why do you put it on Sanders' progressive base, by the way, as opposed to Sanders plus Elizabeth Warren plus some of the others?
Sure. So Bernie's progressive base seems to be more diverse, and these are the group that follows him are also have a lot of things in common with the group that mm-hmm. put Trump into power. And, you know, we've seen this movie before where the DNC puts out their favorite and that guy loses, you know. Clinton and McCaskill, you know, yeah. They're not getting the support that they want.
Andrew got it. Okay, Mike, David, who wants it?
Well, look, there's no doubt that there was a disaffected base in 2016. Partly, there was disappointment in Hillary Clinton. There was lingering bitterness from the primary. I think we're in a different spot here because Donald Trump is not just a sideshow now. He is the show, and it is a show that disturbs a lot of people. You know, you saw the turnout in 2018. Everything that I see indicates a record turnout in 2020, regardless of who the Democratic nominee will be, because there is a great deal of alarm about Trump and a real determination to defeat him. So I don't know whether Biden will be the nominee. As I said earlier, I think he is the favorite right now, but he may not be the nominee. But whomever the nominee is, I think will benefit from a strong Democratic base. And the question is, that smaller cohort of voters who are on the bubble, disaffected Republicans, independents, and so on, what is their posture on the race? Will they vote? Will they vote for the Democrat?
Mike Murphy, on that point, let me ask you as a Republican mm-hmm. strategist to compare this year to 2004, because when George W. Bush was running for re-election, people forget everybody's, soft focusing George Bush these days. But Democrats were so inflamed over the Iraq war and torture in the Iraq war and the tax cuts for the wealthy and his, Christian conservative bent. Democrats were so inflamed in 2004, and they thought they had an electable candidate in John Kerry, and they didn't, or at least, Bush had enough to win. I wonder if that compares as a risk for Democrats in any way, that even with an inflamed base against a Republican incumbent, that you don't necessarily prevail.
Well, that's one of the great equation questions of politics, because often your core supporters tend to project their views on the whole world. I mean, our caller who sounded to me like a Bernie supporter was kind of arguing why Bernie's the most electable. Well, a more dispassionate analysis of what voters Bernie would get and which voters he may not get may be a little more critical of that. So, you know, there's always this, I call it the debate between the mathematicians and the priests on the Republican side, which is it about faith and having the dogma and having the people who vote for you, like, jump 3 feet in the air when they throw the lever, or in a general election, or is it about disappointing them a little bit to get off the dogma and appeal to more people so you get more levers? I've learned in politics that when somebody votes for you, I don't quite care how happy they are. I just want to get a lot of votes. So if the base has to be put under a little bit of pressure because you're reaching out to other voters to get the biggest number, that's the path to win. And so I think what the Democrats are facing now is that same heart and head mathematician versus priest problem of, do we get, you know, Northern California is so excited that instead of winning it by 69 points, we win by 71 and maybe crank up the popular vote, but we don't go dent Trump with those non-college educated white men in the Macomb counties north of Detroit, yeah. Pasco,
this is,
north
this is of
Tampa,
course why.
And they don't win.
This
so
is why Murphy is viewed as an apostate in the Republican ranks today, because the theory in the Republican Party in the era of Trump is just the opposite, which is crank up the base to the max and trying to press the other side, you know, with whatever techniques you can apply, whether it's voter suppression or through social media, and you can win. And there's a pretty vigorous debate, as you know, within Democratic ranks as to whether there is a swing vote anymore, and whether or not, you know, the argument there goes, look, if minority voters and young people had come out in sufficient numbers in 2016, Hillary Clinton would have won, so let's just replicate that. There's a fair amount of work that's been done that suggests that is not necessarily enough. And I kind of subscribe to that view.
Let me go to another call. Amy in Baltimore. You're on WNYC. Hi, Amy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What do you got?
I just want to make a point that I feel like I'm always saying to my radio when, you know, you guys are having these conversations about kind of the electability of the primary candidates, which is that I think a lot of Democrats are capable of holding two thoughts in their head at the same time. I can vote. I'm super pro Warren, and I can vote for Warren in the primary and be all excited about the romance of the transformative change. But if it winds up being Biden, I'm going to vote for Biden, because what am I going to do? Not vote? Or I'm going to vote for Trump? No. So,
right.
Feel like that's the thing that all of my friends and every conversation, it all ends in that. Like, we can go for the person we want, but of course we're going to vote for whoever the nominee is.
Well, Amy, you'd be a great pundit, because you've just figured out what happened with Sarah Palin, one of the great mysteries. Often during the primary, there's a lot of noise on cable TV with the people whose candidate is not winning the primary and saying, well, if our person doesn't win, that does it. I'm staying home in the general election, which, of course, never happens. But during that race, there was a lot of talk after Hillary lost that, well, we're, you know, the women voters are going to stay home. And I can tell you there were a bunch of guys watching television out in the Arizona. And that led to a little of the chain reaction thought of, we need to pick a woman, because according to the TV here, women are up for grabs, not Sarah Palin. It's one of the great myths of American politics. You know, if your second or third choice Democrat wins the nomination, that does not make you a Republican.
Amy, thank you, and call us again. Well, how much tension do the two of you see to sort of the other side of Amy's point? Because I think Amy's saying, you know, even if a progressive is nominated, who's more progressive than some Democrats want, Democrats are going to turn out to defeat Trump. But what about all these suburban women swing voters? Will they necessarily do that. I don't know that we could sit here today and answer that question. But David, for you as a Democratic consultant who helped, you know, manage Obama to victory two times, how do you see that?
Well, look, I mean, my view is that the Democrats, despite the president's attempt to elevate, you know, these four young congresswomen and make them the face of the Democratic Party, there were, you know, 30 or more men and women elected in some of these areas that Trump won, were elected to Congress, Democrats in 2018, who were really the face of what happened in 2018, and they won because people who had previously voted Republican voted Democrat, and that had a lot to do with Donald Trump. Democrats need them to do the same thing in 2020, and they need and some of these non-college educated women. And I hate that discussion, by the way, because I think it carries with it sort of a hint of judgment, which it should not. But that's how we, you know, clinically divide people in our discussions. But the Democrats need some of those folks as well. So I do think that if Democrats run a very ideological campaign, the danger is that you're going to lose those voters when the real issue is Trump. And, you know, yes, you can say, well, that was the mistake that was made in 2016. But as I said before, we're in a wholly different situation. The reality of Donald Trump is now here, and we're experiencing it every day. Just consider the news today between caving to the NRA after saying he was going to move forward on background checks, the Danes, the recession that isn't a recession that he needs remedial steps to deal with, all of that. I mean, and just, you know, every single day carries with it more of this.
And David, did
that, that really for a winning Democratic campaign, the question should be, can we do this for another 4 years? Can we wake up every day to a president who divides for profit and fun, who is engaged in these crazy tweets and tantrums, who picks fights that are wholly unnecessary and creates chaos that gets in the way of actually accomplishing things? I think that has the broadest reach, that argument, that critique. And you don't want there to be a lot of distractions about whether we're going to eliminate private insurance for 150 million Americans.
Steve in Cold Spring, you're on WNYC. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Brian and David and Mike. Thank you for such a fascinating discussion. I think there's a very obvious reason why Trump wants to buy Greenland. He has a long history of trying to capitalize on adversity or even disaster. In this case, with the acceleration of global climate change and the alarming recess, the melting of the ice shelf, this is exposing vast amounts of land that is mineral-rich, oil-rich, exposing it for the first time in millennia. And I think this is classic Trump greed.
Well, the Chinese are after it, too.
Hmm. So there's a grain of serious there when Trump or someone talks about acquiring Greenland.
Yes.
Or maybe it's to increase the white population of the United States, right? Wasn't it in his famous S Whole Country moment, he also was quoted saying he wanted more immigrants from Norway?
It also could be that he just wants, he likes to put his name on stuff. And so Trump land would be, you know, a real jewel in his crown. So it could be that as well.
You know, the other aspect to it, because it's just kind of naturally funny, which is why we're all making Lego jokes and everything. But in the foreign policy establishment, there's huge depression about this, because Denmark has actually been a pretty critical and incredibly steadfast U.S. ally. And they've always been with us. in interpolitical, geopolitical stuff in Europe, which is a complicated politics because there's so many moving parts over there. The Danes were some of the first in some of our foreign conflicts with boots on the ground. So, you know, this was like taking on the Canadians, too. And we're now embarrassing them, the Danes, because our petulant president is stiffing them on a visit, which was a big deal over there. So this beyond the whims of a lunatic who, you know, looks at a map and sees something big and says, you know, me want, and maybe for the minerals, it does real damage, just like these musings about NATO. So this is all an interesting question to me. Will this stuff bubble through in the election, the confidence level, or have we just trained the electorate to be focused on pure reality show theatrics, and that's now the rule of gravity in our presidential politics?
Well,
I can tell you this, though, just as a Repub, if the Dems give Trump a candidate that he can work with and move the focus off firing him, that'll be a critical mistake. And I just don't know if that argument will break through in the primary.
We'll continue in a minute with David Axelrod and Mike Murphy. We will get to their Anthony Scaramucci interview and their podcast this week, and beyond the snark regarding how people react to Scaramucci, could he actually be the catalyst now that he has turned on Trump for getting other major Republicans out of the closet and saying this guy is unfit for office? So we will go there right after we go here. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we continue with Democratic political consultant David Axelrod, very well known for running President Obama's successful campaigns. He also hosts the Axe Files on CNN, and Republican strategist Mike Murphy, who has worked with many leading Republicans, including John McCain and Mitt Romney and many others. Together, David Axelrod and Mike Murphy are now doing a podcast with the self-deprecating title Hacks on Tap. And on your podcast this week, you interviewed Anthony Scaramucci, I listened, former Trump communications director, who is, of course, he was in that position for so short. Was it a matter of
days.
That I've heard somebody refer to measuring time in how many Scaramuccis is it? Anyway, he's now trying to recruit other former Trump appointees to come forward and blow the whistle on just how hateful and epically, fundamentally wrong they really think the Trump presidency is. We'll play a clip of Scaramucci from your podcast in a minute. But I think it's fair to ask, Mike, nobody trusts him, so what's he up to?
Oh, I think in some ways, he's a mirror image of Trump without the worst part.
He's mini-me.
Mini-me, as David said. He's a little bit, shall we say, self-absorbed. But so as a political force, no, he's a general of no army. But if he can get in the media doing this all the time, he'll have an audience of one, Donald Trump, and it'll drive Trump crazy. And because Trump has no discipline, it'll affect how Trump operates. So I actually think, on a kind of a circus insanity of our modern Trump era level, the Mooch could do some damage. And, you know, he's threatening to set up a super PAC, put himself on TV. If he just buys a couple of spots on Fox yelling at the camera, the president will see it and react, and fireworks will ensue.
So here's a clip of Scaramucci. He had written a book not that long ago about Trump and how he won. And here's the advice he gave you for the 2020 Democrats.
If you read the book, which I would encourage every Democratic candidate to read it, I inserted in the book a strategy and a map for how you can defeat him. Because what's happening is that he's so split and divided the country, you can't call his supporters deplorables and white nationalists and all this sort of stuff. You have to do what your friend Pete Buttigieg, not your friend, but the person you interviewed, Mayor Pete Buttigieg, is talking about, is reaching out to them. And all of that is elucidated in the book.
How much do you each agree with that advice? And what is reaching out and citing Buttigieg as a model look like? I mean, David, you know, one risk there, I think, is that kind of reaching out throws people of color under the bus, because Buttigieg has like no black support, without which you can't win and shouldn't win a Democratic nomination.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right, you can't, and he's going to have to do that. But leaving him aside, I mean, Scaramucci, I did a Axe Files TV show with him in July. Scaramucci was impressed by him, and he is impressive. But he's going to have to work that out. But I think Scaramucci's point, you know, Buttigieg says, I think, is right, which is he comes from South Bend. There are people who voted for Barack Obama, Donald Trump, and him. And, you know, so you have to be able to talk to those voters. And I think that Scaramucci's point is the one I was making, a version of the one I was making earlier, which is you need to build a bridge for those who are willing to walk across. And the bridge can't be, you know, you supported a racist, xenophobic madman, so now repent and come with us. Because that's not the way people are not going to respond to that. But if you say, look, whatever went before, we can't do four more years like this just unmitigated chaos that emanates from here. You may have wanted to shake things up, but now it's gone too far, and we have to make a change. We have to stabilize. I think that has the ability to bring people over without making judgments about them. And I think one of the mistakes that Democrats make, and I understand it because some the things that Trump has done are deeply, deeply offensive in so many different ways. But if you then assign everything he's done to every person who voted for him, you're essentially telling them, you are deplorable and we don't want you. And
yeah,
to me, that's not very smart politics.
Well, I want to follow up on that with you, Mike, as a Republican strategist. How do you explain Trump's consistent support among like 90% of Republicans? Because I'll tell you, a lot of Democrats in our New York, New Jersey, Connecticut area where I am call this show and they say, with all that Trump emphasis on white grievance and hatred of Latinos and go back where you came from and everything else, and nothing else is really changing that much for them as workers, etc., ordinary Trump supporters must either be that racist themselves or at least have an extremely high tolerance for racism as a political strategy in their standard bearer.
Well, part of the sport of politics is people love to have a smug off and see who can look down at the other side. I'm a good person because I vote for the good, you know, candidate, my candidate, you're a bad person. It's this new equation we have in politics of I'm right, you're evil. And when you're evil, you can say anything about the other side. But David's right.
You both agree that Trump is evil, more or less, right?
Yeah, look, I'm a Republican conservative, but I want Trump to lose.
So how do you characterize Trump supporters in that context who support him for like 40% of the country that never stopped supporting him despite everything you know?
We're in a very tribal.
But I don't. Go ahead,
yeah,
Mike.
Yeah,
you defend
just
yourself.
Quickly. Yeah, I don't believe you beat Trump by vilifying people who voted for him because remember, there's no time machine. People can't take their vote back halfway through after Charlottesville or a third of the way through. During the campaign, he was the art of the deal guy from television who was going to go in and change all the politicians and throw them out.
But almost every single person who voted for him still supports him, according to the polls. So what are we supposed to think of them?
No. This is a projection. So if you look at every election since he was elected on that pitch, the Republican Party has been punished in the special elections, the midterms, et cetera. We have leakage. We've lost some Republicans. We've lost swing voters we normally attract from the independents. So we're down to a cul-de-sac of Trump's core support. And even if you ask Republicans, they do give him a 90% voter approval. It's like asking Red Sox fans to switch to the Yankees. But if you ask those same Republicans, we've done this on polling at USC, would you prefer a different Republican than Donald Trump as nominee? 40% of them say yes. So, you know, if the Democrats want to wage a moral crusade against Trump voters, they will reelect him.
Yeah, one small point and then a larger one. The small point is that universe of Republicans has gotten smaller because there are a measurable number of Republicans who now identify themselves as independents because they don't want to be counted as Republicans under Trump. And so you've got a smaller universe that he gets a greater rating in. But, you know, you said something at the beginning that I you know, that is so troubling, which is you both view Trump as evil. And, you know, I view the things that he does that way. And that goes to the fundamental point here. I've lived a long life in and around politics. My basic view is that, you know, you win elections, you lose elections. If you lose, the other party gets to make or take the lead on policy. I disagreed vehemently with a lot of the policies of George W. Bush, but I honestly never believed that he was doing them for reasons other than that he thought they were the right things for the country. And in our transition, he was incredibly gracious to us in every conceivable way. Because he understood that he was the trustee of the institution of democracy, and that was his obligation. The thing that is so troubling about Trump is that he doesn't believe in rules, norms, institutions, or laws. They're all to be subjugated to his own needs and his own project, and that is the stuff of authoritarianism, and it is, and authoritarianism, in my view, is evil, and it's antithetical to who we are as a country, but this is not a partisan point, and I think it needs to be called out for what it is.
Victor in Louisiana, you're on WNYC. Hello from New York, Victor. Where in Louisiana?
North Louisiana. But yeah, I was just one. I just had like two questions that I reflect inflect the conversation back to the question of the primary and the nomination.
Sure.
I was listening to a segment recently on 538, and a Republican pundit campaign. Actually, I think he was like a strategist, made a very interesting point, and it's a bit of a tautology, but I think it's still very interesting that. Whoever wins the nomination is the most electable candidate. And he also made a very interesting point about why he thought Biden wasn't a very likely candidate, and that was that Biden is just not a very good campaigner. Usually when it comes to, like, prepping him for debates and things like that, it's a question of, like, making sure he doesn't do things that would shoot him in the foot, or, like, making sure that you contain him rather than, like, directing him to, like, I don't know, win. Basically, so to what extent should we be worried about, like, Biden's difficulties with campaigning? And also, to what extent is this conversation about electability a reflection of, like, broader anxieties about maybe what we think about the other side, with things like race and maybe even sex? Mm-hmm.
Victor, thank you so much. On that, David, I know you did a riff, I think, on the last episode of the podcast on sort of let Biden be Biden, which I think you meant to some degree exactly what Victor's talking about, like let him lean into his gaffes rather than cringe that they may come.
Yeah, that was a guy who was sitting in for me, the great Paul Begala, made that point. I said a long time ago that presidential races are like MRIs for the soul. Whoever you are, people will discover that. And to some degree, they know Joe Biden. It is baked in the cake. You know, the danger is that you let the gaffes become emblematic of decline, because he is the oldest candidate ever to run for president. And the fear about Biden is less about the gaffes and more about, you know, is he up to it? And so, you know, somehow they have to cope with that. And I you know, he has always been a gaffe machine. This has been true throughout his political career. I mean, we dealt with it when he was vice president. I will correct one thing, though. In debates, I don't know how he prepared for the debates in 2007 and 8. He was actually quite good, and one of the reasons that Barack Obama chose him among many as his vice presidential candidate was that he was impressed with the discipline that he showed in those debates, and he showed it again in the vice presidential debate and two vice presidential debates. So, you know, he's capable of it, but he has to prove that he is still has the fastball. And, you know, I agree with the caller that primaries are proving grounds. You know, you have to run the gauntlet to prove that you're up to this. And I think most Democrats believe that if Joe Biden isn't up to the fight, better to find out in the fall of 2019 than the fall of 2020.
Mike, we have 15 seconds for a last word.
Okay,
15 seconds.
All righty. If Biden wins the nomination, the best thing he has going for him is it's going to be tough to win. So the victory will be worth something, and he'll be a much better candidate, and he'll look like a winner because he's prevailed in a tough race, not a walk.
Democratic political consultant David Axelrod and Republican political consultant Mike Murphy are now co-hosts of the podcast Hacks on Tap. Thanks so much for sharing some of your thoughts
with
us. We really appreciate all the time.
Thank you. It was fun.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.